Agatha. Danbury House, Agatha's private reading room, 12th of January, 1762.
Lord and Lady Smythe Smith are here to see you, my lady.
Agatha sighed heavily. She did not want to receive guests, but it had been a month since her husband's death. Good manners dictated that she be left alone for the first few weeks of her mourning, but now it was time for society to pay their respects. She stood, smoothing her black skirts. I shall receive them in the drawing room.
Very good, my lady,
her butler said.
I have already put them there.
Of course.
Along with the Duke of Hastings.
What? Agatha groaned. She had not liked the man when he was Frederick Bassett, and she did not like him now that he was the Duke of Hastings.
And Lord and Lady Kent.
Is the Tsar of Russia here as well?
No, my lady.
The Danbury butler had never had a sense of humour. Herman had hired him, of course.
But Lord and Lady Hallowell are here.
Agatha regarded the butler with something approaching horror. And they're all in our drawing room.
I sent for tea, my lady.
But no biscuits, Agatha said. I don't want them to stay long.
Of course not, my lady.
He opened the door to her reading room so that she could exit and then followed her out. It is so kind of you all to call, she said, once she'd entered the drawing room. It was packed to the gills. It seemed like half the Newton were there. She greeted each of them separately, then took a seat on her new sofa. Gold damask, of course. It had been ordered before Lord Danbury's death.
Agatha, darling, Lady Smythe Smith said, we are devastated for you, for your loss. We grieve.
Do you? Agatha wanted to say. No one had liked Herman Danbury, except maybe the new Duke of Hastings.
He was a great man,
the Duke said.
He was a champion,
Lord Smythe Smith said. Rounded out by Lady Smythe Smith once again chiming in.
We do grieve.
Agatha waited for a moment. She looked at the Kents and the Halliwells, standing behind the Smythe Smiths. Their faces were painted with their most compassionate expressions, but they seemed inclined to let the others do the talking. However, Agatha finally said. The air positively strained under the weight of unspoken words. There is a however here, is there not? Because surely they would not have all come at once to pay their respects. Condolence calls were normally made one by one. Lord Smythe Smith cleared his throat.
There is indeed a however, and we do apologise for descending on mess. But we need to know, what happens now?
What happens now? Agatha echoed.
What have you heard?
He asked.
What do you become? His wife wondered.
What do we become?
The Duke of Hastings said with greater force. Forgive me, Agatha said, looking from one face to the next. I have not the faintest notion of what you speak.
You are a trusted member of the court, Lord Smythe Smith said.
You are a favourite of the Queen, his wife said.
The Duke of Hastings leaned forward.
Surely the palace has given you some word on procedure, on what will happen next?
Agatha blinked. Next?
Lord Denbury was the first of us to pass away,
Lord Smythe Smith burst out. He mopped his brow with a handkerchief.
The first titled gentleman on our side. And you have a son.
Oh. Oh. Agatha finally understood. You are asking me if my 4-year-old son is now Lord Danbury.
We need to know whether the laws of succession on their side will apply to our side. Does he inherit the title?
I never thought, Dear God. Danbury had been dead for a month, and it had never occurred to her to wonder if they would keep his title. She had just assumed her son's position was guaranteed. She looked up at the dozen or so faces fixed upon hers. We could lose it all in a generation.
Yes, Lady Smythe Smith said. What you lose, we lose. You set the precedent. You are the precedent.
The Duke of Hastings regarded her with a surly frown. Will you remain Lady Danbury, or are you just Mrs. Danbury? I will find out, Agatha said. What choice did she have?
As soon as possible, if you please, the Duke said.
Lady Smythe Smith laid her hand on Agatha's.
We are depending on you. All of us.
Agatha smiled weakly. Once again, the fate of the great experiment lay heavily on her shoulders. Danbury House, Lord Danbury's study. Later that day. Agatha opened yet another drawer, rifling through papers. She should have done this sooner, if not to settle the matter of inheritance, then because she was now a woman alone, and she ought to understand her finances. Frankly, she ought to have understood her finances when Lord Danbury was alive, but he would never have allowed access.
Damn it, Herman, she muttered.
His files were ordered with no rhyme or reason. He was not a stupid man. He should have done better. Coral slipped into the room and shut the door behind her.
His valet did not have any information, she said. Neither did the butler. Maybe Lord Danbury did not have a solicitor.
My husband had a solicitor, Agatha said. He met with him numerous times about things. What sorts of things, Agatha did not know. She had not paid attention. Clearly, she should have done.
I only need to find his name.
Coral stood by the door for a few moments, idly picking at the fabric of her apron.
I do try to look on the bright side, my lady.
Agatha looked up with either astonishment or disbelief. She honestly wasn't sure which.
The bright side?
She echoed. She was having difficulty locating that lately.
You are free, Coral said. Is that not what you wanted?
Agatha let out a humorless sigh.
Do you think me free? I thought I would be. I thought Lord Danbury's death would leave me unencumbered, but all I find is that I am saddled with the burden of what it means to be a woman, not tied to a man.
Is that not good?
Agatha shrugged.
Who knows? I'm on my own, but life is out of reach. I have no new freedoms. All I can be certain of is mourning, embroidery, and quiet teas with other widows. Forever.
Coral said nothing. What was there to say? Agatha slammed one drawer shut and yanked open another.
And now I cannot find the name of the solicitor. I am tasked with preserving the titles of dozens of good people, and I can't even find the name of the man who can help me.
Would it be so bad, my lady?
Coral asked.
Losing the title?
Agatha looked up.
Yes, Coral, it would be bad. They showed up here, all of them, looking for answers, depending on me.
Surely it's not your responsibility.
I made it my responsibility when I insisted on hosting that ball. When I asked the king and queen to attend, we have given the new ton hope, a taste of rare air, equality.
They will not be able to let it go so easily. She flipped through another stack of papers.
And why should they?
But
I found it.
Agatha held up a letter, triumphant.
The solicitor?
Yes.
She looked at the name. A Mr. Margate, He will handle this. He will know what to do. I will write to him, and he will come.
Agatha took her seat behind Lord Danbury's desk and began to compose a letter. But then Coral asked,
Do you really think a solicitor will come to see a woman?
Damn. Sometimes she hated men, truly.
I shall simply sign the letter, Danbury. Let us hope he assumes I am a man with poor etiquette. But won't he know that his lordship has died?
He shall think I'm a brother, or cousin, or anyone but me. That is how men are.
I do hope you are right, my lady.
I have to be, Agatha said, with a sigh.
I cannot be wrong. Not in this.
Danbury House, Agatha's bedchamber. 3 days later.
A gentleman is here to see you.
A gentleman? Agatha looked up from her book.
He says he is the solicitor, Coral said, looking for the lady who does not sign her full name.
Oh my goodness! Agatha shot off the bed. Am I presentable? Does this dress look serious enough?
It is black, my lady. Black is always serious.
Yes, I suppose you're right. Mourning is a serious business.
He is waiting in Lord Danbury's study.
Agatha nodded, shoving her feet into shoes.
Wish me luck. You shall not need it.
Agatha gave her a grateful smile and then hurried down the stairs. Mr. Margate, she said, when she reached her late husband's study. Thank you for coming. He was old and bewigged and looked, as she supposed, a solicitor ought. She moved to Lord Danbury's side of the desk and motioned to the other chair.
Please, sit.
I'm afraid I do not have good news.
Agatha clenched her teeth, but somehow she managed to sound calm when she said, Please elaborate.
There is simply no precedent for a case such as this. Not for nothing did they call it an experiment.
And my husband was the first to die. Mr. Margate grimaced. Agatha had little experience with solicitors, none, really, but even she could tell that his expression was a special one they employed when they were about to deliver bad tidings.
The trouble is, he said, the title and estate were very specifically bestowed on the late Lord Danbury. God rest his soul. Not on you.
Of course not, Agatha said impatiently. Titles are almost never bestowed on women.
Normally, it would all pass to the next Lord Danbury.
I do have a son, you know. Mr. Margate acknowledged this with the briefest of nods.
But nowhere was it clarified whether these new peerages pass to a new generation. It's quite possible they revert to the crown.
Leaving me, Lady Nothing, with nothing but my husband's old house and money. Mr. Margate made that expression again. Oh no, Agatha said. Now what?
It is only,
he sighed heavily.
When your husband accepted the new estate, he used a sizable amount of his holdings to support your new life. Tailors, club payments, horses, extra staff.
Agatha shook her head.
There was no way she believed what she was hearing.
My husband had one of the greatest fortunes in all the continent. Have you heard of Sierra Leone, Mr. Margate? Do you know the riches there, the diamond mines?
I am afraid your husband may have exaggerated his wealth to you. He also spent quite a bit to maintain a life worthy of a lord.
He had not possessed the title for long.
But even before, his clothing, your clothing.
He eyed her black bombazine as if that was somehow responsible for her current downfall. Agatha wanted to scream. She wanted to leap across the desk and wring this man's throat. But she didn't. She held on to her dignity,
because apparently that was all she had to hang on to. "You say he spent more freely once he was made a lord," she said. Mr. Margate nodded. "So, due to this peerage, which we may not even be able to keep, I am to be left, what, penniless? What about our old house?" They had not been in this new estate long.
"It was leased. The owners have already let it to new tenants."
"I am not just penniless, I am homeless too." Mr. Margate grimaced again. Agatha was starting to wonder if they taught that particular expression as a part of law studies. One could not be certified as a solicitor until one learned the bad news grimace. It needed just a touch of false sympathy to truly qualify.
"What am I to do?" she asked.
"Why, what all impoverished widows do. Seek the kindness of a male relative. Or remarry."
Danbury House, the front hall. 2 days later. Mr. Margate was right. Agatha did need to seek the help of a male relative. The galling part, though, was that this male relative was her 4-year-old son.
"Dominic, please," she said, as she waited by the door, "let Nanny tie your cravat."
"Come, scamp," Nanny said. "It is just a neckerchief."
"More like a hangman's noose,"
Dominic howled. Agatha rolled her eyes. He had no idea.
"Oh ho," Nanny scolded. "Such impertinence."
He grinned at her. It was a smile he never gave to his own parents. Agatha felt a twinge of regret. She would do something about that. She would be a better mother than she had been. But today was not the day for her to tease out his smiles.
"Dominic, stop that at once," she said sternly. "This is an important day, and you must behave."
He looked to Nanny for guidance. She gave him a little nod.
"Be a good boy," she said. "Listen to your mother."
Agatha took his hand and led him out to the waiting carriage.
"When are we returning to Nanny?"
he asked. Agatha swallowed.
"Dominic," she said,
her voice softer than it had been for weeks.
"I am sorry you do not know me. I did not know my parents well either, and I know it must be very frightening to leave Nanny like this. But I am your mother, and your father is gone to the angels, and now you are the man of the family."
He looked at her with solemn 4-year-old eyes.
"The man of the family?
God help them." Agatha soldiered on. "Your family needs you to do your duty."
"All right, then."
He thought about that for a moment, then brightened.
"We are going to meet a princess."
"We are."
"A real one?"
"Very real."
"Will she be wearing a crown?"
Agatha thought about that. She didn't think she had ever seen Princess Augusta without a tiara.
"Probably."
"Will she like me?"
"I do not see how she could not."
Dominic smiled. He peered out the window as they began their journey. It would not take long. The new Danbury house was exceedingly well located, barely a mile away from St. James's Palace.
"Did you know I can count, Mother?"
Dominic asked. Agatha had not known this, but she lied and said,
"Of course."
1, 2, 3.
His little head nodded with each number.
4.
He paused.
"I am 4.
"I know."
"The next is 5,
he said.
"That is what I will be soon."
"Perhaps we shall have a party."
"With cake and biscuits?"
"Absolutely with cake and biscuits."
Dominic clapped his hands together and resumed his count.
6 comes next,
he said.
"Then 7, 8.
He looked back up.
I'll need help after 19.
I can help you, Agatha said. And thus it was that they found themselves at 143 when they stepped down from the carriage. She took Dominic's hand. Just remember to do as I told you. Agatha handed her calling card to the butler, even though he knew very well who she was.
Is the princess expecting you?
He asked.
She is not, Agatha replied, but she will receive me.
The butler motioned for them to wait on a bench in one of the grand hallways. A few moments later, he returned. Again, Agatha took her son's hand. It felt small, and yet he was already older than she was when her fate had been sealed with her betrothal to Herman Danbury. They followed the butler to Princess Augusta's sitting room. She was in her customary spot on her sofa, her wide skirt taking up almost the entire cushion. As usual, Lord Bute and Earl Harcourt stood behind her, one on each side. Agatha ignored them, instead directing her words directly to the princess.
I thought it high time, Your Royal Highness, that you met my son, Lord Danbury.
She gave Dominic's shoulder a little squeeze of encouragement, and he executed a darling bow before saying,
Lovely to meet you, Your Highness.
Princess Augusta smiled, obviously charmed by this display of cuteness.
A pleasure to meet you, Lord.
Lord Bute let out a violent cough. Augusta turned away from Agatha and Dominic.
Are you quite all right?
She asked Bute.
The question of inheritance,
he whispered. Agatha had to pretend not to hear.
It is far from decided, Earl Harcourt said.
The concerns involved.
Agatha wasn't able to get the end of that sentence, but she did hear Earl Harcourt quite clearly when he said to Princess Augusta,
Do you understand the implications?
Silence. Princess Augusta turned back to her guests.
Such a handsome boy, she said. Pray, both of you call on us again soon.
With a flick of her wrist, she bid them gone. There was nothing more Agatha could say, not right there in front of Bute, Harcourt, and Dominic, so she curtsied and backed out of the room.
Did I do my duty, Mother?
Dominic asked once they were back in the hall. He hadn't, but he'd tried. They'd both tried. Agatha knelt before him, taking his little hands in hers.
You showed them who you are.
He looked at her with a solemn expression.
Dominic Danbury, son of Herman Danbury.
Yes, you are. And you are Lord Danbury. And you will take your rightful place because you are entitled to it. And because you are my son too. You are the son of Agatha Danbury, born name Somer, royal blood of the Bomende tribe in Sierra Leone. You come from warriors.
Warriors? He whispered. We win.
She squeezed his hands.
Never forget that.
She needed only to remember that herself. Brimsley. Buckingham House, the King's Gardens. 31st of January, 1762. Nearly 2 months had passed since the King's episode. Episode. Brimsley did not know what else to call it, but by God, episode seemed far too benign. He was not sure he could ever forgive Reynolds for keeping a secret of that nature. Yes, he understood Reynolds's need to defend the King, but surely the Queen had had a right to know. Which meant that Brimsley should have been told. He could have supported her. He could have prepared her. Very well. He could not have prepared her. Nothing could have prepared her for that. But he could have tried. He could have done something so it wasn't quite so stunningly horrific. As for the king, he had not been seen at Buckingham House even once since that fateful day. He had departed for Kew and refused to receive visitors. Not even the queen. She wrote him letters. She wrote him so many letters, but she received no response. Brimsley tried to get answers, but Reynolds told him almost nothing. Just that the king had returned to his scientific pursuits, and that he was receiving treatment for his malady. Brimsley had asked him what sort of treatment, because, honestly, what did one do for such a thing? But Reynolds had told him that it was none of his business, and also to shut up. Brimsley was not happy with Reynolds these days.
"Are you warm enough, Your Majesty?"
he asked. It was mild for December, but still it was December, and they were standing at the edge of the King's Gardens.
"Yes," she replied. "I shall not be outside for long."
Brimsley looked out over the garden patch. It was no longer bursting with life, but several hardy vegetables still grew and bloomed. It was remarkable, really.
"The king is quite talented," he said.
"I beg your pardon?"
"To have cultivated plants that grow through the winter."
"He does like his science." Brimsley peered down.
"What is it? Broccoli? Tiny cabbages? I am sure they are delicious."
"Have them harvested, given to the poor," she said.
"Right away, Your Majesty."
He was just deciding who best to contact about this when a footman hurried over.
"Princess Augusta has arrived," the footman said quietly.
Brimsley tried not to audibly groan. "Has he written?" the Queen asked. There was hope in her voice. It was the hope that hurt the most.
"I'm afraid not, Your Majesty. It is the Dowager Princess."
The Queen made no attempt to hide her displeasure. "What does she want?" Brimsley looked to the footman.
"She has arrived with Lord Bute," the footman said.
"I am not receiving visitors," Charlotte said, and marched away. The footman grabbed Brimsley's arm.
"There is more," he said urgently. "She has brought the royal physician."
The Queen turned around, having obviously overheard the footman. "I absolutely refuse to see the physician." Buckingham House, the Queen's bedchamber. 30 minutes later, the royal physician was examining the Queen, who was flat on her back in her bed, skirts up, legs spread. Brimsley was standing at the far wall, scrupulously facing away. Princess Augusta had tried to order him to leave, but the Queen had intervened. She had not said so, but Brimsley rather thought she wanted an ally. He hoped she saw him as such. It had taken her some time to forgive him for what she had perceived as his disloyalty. He hoped she understood that he had truly not known the extent of the king's illness. Or really, that he was ill at all.
"You are taking a long time," Princess Augusta said, presumably to the doctor.
"A very long time," Lord Bute added.
"I am precise," the doctor replied. The Queen let out a sigh, more of a groan, really.
"Your Majesty,"
Brimsley called out. He had seen the doctor's devices before she had taken her place on the bed. They had looked like instruments of torture, all shiny metal and weird shapes. Brimsley didn't know a whole lot about the female body. Honestly, he'd probably learned as much as the Queen during Lady Danbury's lesson at tea all those months ago. But he did not see how any of these awful contraptions were meant to fit anywhere.
"It is nothing,"
the Queen replied stoically.
"It is not nothing," the doctor finally said. "She is with child."
Princess Augusta made a sound that approached glee.
"It is done, then?"
"Are you certain?" Lord Bute asked.
"There can be no doubt," the doctor stated.
Doubts are the better part of a woman's insides, Princess Augusta pronounced. Brimsley winced. What the devil did that mean?
Are you as sure as you can be?
Princess Augusta continued.
Oh, quite sure, the doctor said. In fact, Her Majesty is quite far along, making magnificent progress.
Thank God, Lord Bute said. Can we announce?
Not until the quickening, Princess Augusta said, with the tone of one plotting a strategic assault. When will that be?
Before the month is done, I should expect, the doctor said. The princess let out another little gleeful chirp. Congratulations, Your Highness, Lord Bute said to Princess Augusta. He was beaming.
I should think congratulations are due as much to you, Lord Bute, she replied.
And what of the Queen? Brimsley wondered. Why was no one congratulating her? She was the one growing a baby in her womb. She was the only one in the room who had actually contributed to the making of this royal heir. Brimsley stole a look at her. He was closer to her head than her feet, so he did not see anything untoward. He caught her eye. She looked to the ceiling, then sighed.
Is she done yet?
Brimsley inquired, because honestly, she did not look comfortable. He was ignored. Princess Augusta moved to Charlotte's head and peered right down at her.
I will have my things moved over to Buckingham House at once.
Brimsley winced. The Queen would not like that. Augusta patted her on the shoulder. It was probably meant to be maternal, but to Brimsley, there was something monstrous about it. Poor Charlotte on the table, with Augusta's face filling her entire vision.
You carry the crown, Princess Augusta said. Your safety is most important. I shall not leave you alone for a moment. We shall wait for the future king's arrival together.
Together, the queen said weakly.
Doctor?
Princess Augusta said.
That thing is still inside her.
Oh, right. Sorry about that. He pulled something out of the queen. It looked rather like an iron duck.
Brimsley really wished he had not been watching. It was not easy being a man who loved men, but by God, it was better than being a woman.
Kew Palace, the front portico. 24th of February, 1762.
Another one?
Reynolds asked.
She writes to him at least twice each week, Brimsley said. You should not be surprised that I'm here to deliver another letter.
We usually meet in the park.
The Queen has received no replies to the letters I have delivered to you in the park. I thought it prudent to travel to Kew myself.
Brimsley, Reynolds said on a sigh. He raked his hand through his hair.
Brimsley, please.
What?
Just that...
But Reynolds did not finish his sentence. He never finished any sentences about the king.
The queen suffers,
Brimsley said. His voice was sharp, sharper than he'd ever used with Reynolds. Reynolds just shook his head.
You know I cannot. My duty...
She suffers!
Brimsley all but snapped.
I can't. I am not able. Much as I would love to stand here and help you find your words, I have my own duties to attend to. Deliver the letter to His Majesty.
Brimsley handed him the envelope and started to walk away, but then Reynolds called out his name.
Wait.
Brimsley turned.
I want you to know,
Reynolds said, haltingly.
I deliver them. I deliver them all. Personally.
And is he reading them?
Reynolds swallowed uncomfortably.
I do not know. I could not say.
Brimsley very much suspected that meant no.
Perhaps there is something we can do, he said, to bring them back together. Surely that is what is best.
Reynolds looked dubious, almost pained.
I have scrubbed the walls clean, Brimsley told him. There is no more trace of that night, and we can shield the garden. If His Majesty requires time to bathe in the moonlight without his garments, we can build a screen. A screen, Reynolds repeated with disbelief. You think this can be solved with a screen? There is something else, Brimsley said. Her Majesty. She is in a state I have never seen before. I worry, Reynolds. I fear the Queen teeters on disaster. I wonder if Her Majesty might better see that man again, the King's doctor, for her mind this time. Absolutely not, Reynolds said sharply. Reynolds, just listen. I said no.
And this time, it was a roar. Brimsley felt his face grow hot.
You give me nothing, he seethed. You tell me nothing but lies. I ask for your help, and you refuse to treat me like a partner or equal. I cannot help you,
Reynolds thundered. Or was it a wail? It was somehow both. But he snatched the letter from Brimsley's hand before heading back to the front door. Brimsley shook his head and headed back to his coach.
Wait!
Brimsley turned around.
Tell her. Tell her he misses her, Reynolds said. Does he?
He does. I am sure of it.
Has he said this?
Brimsley asked. Reynolds did not answer. No, then. Brimsley kept this in mind when he returned to Buckingham House later that day. Any word? The Queen asked him. She was on her way to sit for a portrait and had been dressed in her wedding finery. It was painfully ironic.
I am afraid not, Your Majesty.
You are sure he is receiving the letters? Brimsley was sure that he was not receiving them, or at the very least, that he was not reading them. But he avoided an outright lie by saying,
I am delivering them, Your Majesty.
The Queen frowned and peered down the hall. Is she still here? She asked, referring to Princess Augusta. She has not fallen down a flight of stairs or choked on a cube of meat.
I am sorry to report that she remains alive and well, Your Majesty.
The Queen groaned.
It is time to sit for your portrait, Your Majesty,
Brimsley reminded her. She groaned again, although perhaps not quite as loudly as she had about Princess Augusta.
It is so tedious.
And yet an indispensable part of royal life, Your Majesty. A queen must be remembered for the ages.
It is odd, isn't it? My likeness shall hang on these walls for centuries, and yours shall not.
She did not mean to be unkind. Brimsley knew this. She was simply the queen. She was different.
You should also be remembered in some way, the queen said. Perhaps we all should.
That sounds almost revolutionary, Your Majesty.
It does, doesn't it? She gave him a humourless smile. It is probably because I chafe so keenly with the Dowager Princess in residence.
As do we all, Brimsley murmured.
You grow bold, Brimsley, the Queen said.
My apologies.
None required, the Queen answered, striding into the salon where she'd been sitting for the royal portrait.
There you are,
Princess Augusta trilled.
Speak of the devil, Charlotte muttered.
Brimsley tried not to smile.
Mr. Ramsay has been waiting for you,
Princess Augusta said.
Please resume your pose.
Right this way, Your Majesty,
Brimsley said, leading her to her assigned spot.
May I get you anything? Refreshment?
She is not drinking a glass of lemonade in the portrait,
Princess Augusta said. I shall be fine, the Queen told him. Brimsley moved back to his spot at the edge of the room. This was at least the fourth sitting Queen Charlotte had done. It was excruciatingly dull, but she looked magnificent. Her hair had been dressed like a cloud to support her bridal tiara, just as it had been on the day of her wedding. How could anyone not love her?
Are we almost finished? The Queen asked.
I am afraid I am not even half done, Mr. Ramsay said.
Ramsay,
said the Queen. That cannot be true. I'm not so large a woman.
No, Your Majesty, but...
He turned the canvas around. Brimsley stepped forward for a better look. Queen Charlotte was nearly done, and an excellent likeness it was. But beside her, nothing but a yawning blank space where the king ought to be.
We still need the king, Mr. Ramsay said, awkwardly.
He is not yet available,
Princess Augusta said.
Nevertheless, the artist said, it is a wedding portrait, by His Majesty's request.
Yes, the Queen said pointedly. His Majesty requested a wedding portrait.
His Majesty is quite thoughtful,
Princess Augusta said. Brimsley's eyes flicked from woman to woman. There were entire conversations going on between their spoken words. Diatribes. Wars. My skin is too light, the Queen said suddenly. She turned to the artist. Paint my skin darker, as it actually is.
Your Majesty, Ramsay said.
Brimsley almost felt sorry for him.
Let me see,
Princess Augusta said. She rose from her position on the sofa and inspected the half-finished portrait.
No,
she said, in that sharp voice of hers.
Paint her skin lighter, pale. His Majesty wants her to glow.
Queen and Princess stared each other down.
I shall be painted as I am, Queen Charlotte said. You shall be painted as your subjects wish you to be,
Princess Augusta said.
Perhaps we should be done for the day?
Brimsley cut in. He scooted between the two women.
You are tired, are you not?
He said to the Queen. Her eyes narrowed with rage.
I am...
tired,
he cut in, before she could say something he would regret. She wouldn't regret it. Of that he was sure, but he would, because he would have to deal with the aftermath.
You are with child,
he said.
You deserve solitude and restful company.
He looked over at Mr. Ramsay with a pointed expression. And we have lost the light, have we not?
Oh,
Mr. Ramsay said. Oh yes, the clouds. They blew in so quickly.
We are inside,
Princess Augusta pointed out.
Nevertheless,
Mr. Ramsay said.
Another day, perhaps,
Brimsley said. He turned to the Queen.
Your Majesty, perhaps you would like to lie down?
Yes, she said. But there was something about her tone that unnerved him. I need to write another letter.
Another one, Your Majesty?
Brimsley was surprised. She usually waited at least a day.
I do correspond with people other than my husband, she said, sweeping out of the room.
She did.
You do?
He asked.
Stop following me,
she said.
You know I cannot.
Perhaps I just like to say it.
Then I shall continue to enjoy hearing it.
She halted in place, just long enough to let out a loud, frustrated groan. Brimsley waited patiently. He was used to this.
It was not the first time she had done this. She marched on to her bedchamber, then stopped at the door. "I assume you will be waiting here until I emerge?"
"Of course, Your Majesty."
"Good. I shall see you when I see you." She shut the door in his face. He was used to that, too. Kew Palace, the entry hall. Later that night.
"You are back," Ranald said.
"I am, and it is not good."
"What do you mean?"
Brimsley tried to ignore the acid burning up his throat.
"I have another letter."
"Already?"
"It is not for the king."
"Then why have you brought it here?"
"She has written to Duke Adolphus."
Reynolds's surprise showed clearly on his face.
"What? The queen's brother? In Germany?"
"What for?"
"Because she cannot leave England without a country to give her safe haven."
"What?"
Reynolds turned away before twisting right back.
"No.
She would not leave."
"She would. She is miserable, Reynolds. I have tried to tell you."
"And you are sure that she is asking?"
"I am sure."
Brimsley was not proud of himself, but he had used ice to freeze the seal so that he could pop it open without breaking it. He'd read the Queen's private correspondence before carefully resealing it.
"Oh," Reynolds said.
"Oh? Oh? That is all you have to say? Reynolds, I have read the private correspondence of the Queen. I am fairly certain that is a hanging offence."
"I shall not tell."
"I know that,"
Brimsley said, frustrated beyond measure.
"I tell you merely to demonstrate the lengths to which I am willing to go to protect her. I am worried, Reynolds. I am scared."
Reynolds shook his head, the blank, mindless motion of one who has no answers.
"What do you want of me?"
"Help me," Brimsley begged. "Do I post it?"
"You ask me?"
"Yes, I ask you. No one else has the ear of the king. This is... She wants to leave."
Reynolds looked away, at some far-off nothingness on the horizon.
"I can fail to post it," Brimsley said. "Shall I fail to post it?"
Reynolds swallowed uncomfortably.
"That is up to your discretion."
"No, it is our... We work together. You can tell His Majesty. He will take action. Come back to her. All will be solved."
Brimsley waited, but still, Reynolds did not answer.
"Shall I fail to post it?"
Brimsley asked yet again. Reynolds closed his eyes. He looked to be in pain.
"There is nothing that can be done. Post it."
Brimsley swore. He swore at this untenable situation, and he swore at this man he thought he might love.
"Everything is in danger," he warned, "and you keep secrets."
"They are not my secrets to reveal," Reynolds said.
He walked away. Brimsley supposed he ought to be used to that, too.
Charlotte.
Buckingham House, the receiving room. 22nd of April, 1762. Charlotte was sick of reading. She was sick of needlework. She was sick of directing the servants to prepare baskets for the poor. She was sick of everything. She was bored and she was lonely. And the only fun she had was trying to devise new ways to avoid Princess Augusta, who she swore must be a witch, because by God, that woman was everywhere. Unescapable menace person. That was going to be her new word. George had told her it was her right as queen to make up all the words she wanted. Over mother fuss. There was a certain elegance to that one. Or maybe She ought to go back to the tried and true. Back Pfeifengesicht. A face in need of a fist. Well, this was the most fun she'd had in weeks. Brimsley entered the room with a little click of his heels. She thought he might be trying to act a bit more German for her. It was rather sweet.
Your Majesty, he said, Duke Adolphus Frederick IV of Mecklenburg-Strelitz has arrived.
Her brother. Charlotte was overcome with a deep sense of relief. Finally, he was here. She could go home. Adolphus entered the room and made a profoundly formal bow. Charlotte shot Brimsley a look. Where is she? They both knew she was talking about Augusta.
I believe she's with her modiste.
Charlotte breathed a sigh of relief. Wait outside, Brimsley. He didn't look happy about it, but he went. Adolphus bowed again.
Your Majesty.
She rolled her eyes. Get up, you look ridiculous. He smirked.
It is good to see you as well, sister.
You could not make it any faster, she demanded.
Mein Gott, being queen suits you.
Charlotte pushed herself to her feet. She'd started to become a bit awkward in her own body and went to his side. She smiled up at his beloved face and then gave him a hug.
I would have been here sooner, but it was a hard crossing, Adolphus said. I still cannot keep food down.
That we have in common. She stepped back and adjusted her gown, revealing her increasing midsection.
Your Majesty!
He beamed with delight.
I am to be an uncle. Such happy news.
Only I am not happy. She clutched his hand in hers. I want to go home, Adolphus.
Home? Nonsense. And besides...
He motioned to their luxurious surroundings.
This is your home now.
Spoken with utter pomposity and condescension. God, she hated men sometimes. Don't you dare accuse me of nonsense, Charlotte bit off. You shall take me home, now, and you cannot refuse me. When we came here, you told me you could not say no to the British Empire, and now I am their queen.
You are emotional, Adolphus said.
Please, she drawled. Say that one more time. I shall have you beheaded.
Charlotte, he said, in just the most patronizing tone. Inside you ripens the fruit of England, and until that fruit is ripe, your body is but a...
Do not call me a flower, she warned.
A tree, he said instead. Such an improvement. You are a tree in the orchard of the crown, and at such a time as it will bloom.
I am a tree, Charlotte said flatly. She was going to kill him.
I mean to say only that the child inside you is not yours.
It is my body that is growing it.
What matter?
What matter? You grow it, then.
Your body is not your own, Adolphus said sternly. To leave the kingdom now would be treason. Kidnapping. An act of war, perhaps.
I only want to be home, Charlotte said. She could hear the tears burbling beneath her voice. She'd known she was unhappy, but she had not realized just how desperately so until she'd seen her brother's face. I want to be at Schloss Miraux, with my own family, she said. She was trying so hard not to cry. Queens did not cry.
I am not your family now, Adolphus said.
He sounded regretful, but not enough to help her.
Of course not, she muttered. I have been bartered like livestock. You sold me. Charlotte.
It is true, You sold me, and that means my family is no longer my own.
King George is your family now, Adolphus said. Unless...
His face took on an expression of true concern.
Is there something wrong, Charlotte? Something, perhaps, that you could not put into writing?
No, she said quickly. Hopefully not too quickly. But she could not reveal George's secret. She was desperately unhappy, but she could never betray him this way. Whatever was happening, it was not his fault. Adolphus continued to probe.
He is not hurting you, is he?
No, of course not. Everything is fine. She must have convinced him, because he said,
That is a relief to hear. It would have been most difficult to take a stand. I would have done so, of course. You are my sister. But still.
She wasn't sure she liked the level of relief in his tone. What are you saying, Adolphus? He noticed a plate of biscuits on a side table and walked over to take one.
I negotiated your engagement brilliantly. I was able to forge an alliance between our province and Great Britain.
An alliance, Charlotte said. That is why you married me off to these people.
It was good for everyone. He took a bite. This is delicious.
Adolphus!
Sorry.
He chewed and swallowed.
But, Charlotte, the lions were at the gate. This alliance, it means Mecklenburg-Strelitz is defended by the might of Great Britain.
Of course. She said. She already knew all of this. It was simply the first time her brother had said it so explicitly.
Our fates are tied,
Adolphus continued, oblivious to her turmoil,
which is why it is good you are happy here.
She stared at him. He smiled cluelessly. But what would it matter? She said with a sigh. My body is his, is it not? My body belongs to the entire bloody country.
Charlotte.
We have Tartarian pheasants now, she announced. And she smiled. Her beautiful, empty, queenly smile. Would you like to see them? His entire face lit up.
That would be marvelous. Show me everything. What a life you lead, sister. Simply glorious. Glorious indeed.
Buckingham House, the dining room. Later that evening. As usual, Augusta was inescapable. Charlotte had hoped for a relatively informal meal with her brother, but once the Dowager Princess heard that he was in residence, she insisted upon joining them.
It is so lovely of you to pay your sister a visit, Augusta said. When I married, I hardly saw my family again. Charlotte, you are fortunate.
Charlotte stared down at her plate. Seule meuniere. With George gone, they were allowed to eat fish.
Charlotte?
Hmm? She broke out of her daze. Her brother was regarding her with concern. So was Augusta. Or whatever it was that passed for concern on her face.
She's exhausted, Augusta said. Confinement, I remember it well. Carrying a future king is not easy.
It could be a girl, Charlotte murmured.
And of course, that would be perfectly acceptable, Augusta said. I myself had a daughter before my darling George.
She turned to Adolphus.
She will likely be married soon. We are in negotiations with the House of Brunswick.
My felicitations.
Charlotte sighed.
Where is the current king?
Adolphus asked.
Will His Majesty be joining us?
His Majesty has business,
Augusta said, dabbing her mouth delicately with her napkin.
Charlotte has been such a support for him.
Charlotte stared at the window. She could go through that window. She'd open it first. She was not that insane. But she could go through it and just walk away.
Your Majesty?
Augusta said, pointedly. Charlotte blinked. I'm sorry.
We were talking about what a support you are for His Majesty.
Oh, yes, of course. She managed a small smile. I write him letters.
Letters?
Adolphus asked. He is at Kew, Charlotte replied. She brought a bite of sole to her mouth, then put it down. Too fishy for her pregnant nose. Wasn't that just the most exquisite irony? She finally had fish at the table and couldn't bear to eat it.
Kew,
Adolphus said.
It is His Majesty's other London estate,
Augusta said quickly. She shot a warning look to Charlotte. Charlotte closed her eyes. She was tired.
Is it near to Buckingham House?
Adolphus asked.
Oh, yes, Augusta said. Very near. It is where he likes to conduct his scientific experiments. He has an observatory.
Yes, Charlotte said dutifully. It is a one-of-a-kind magnificent observatory, the only one in England.
Georgie has quite the brilliant mind,
Augusta went on.
Truly, one of the greatest of our generation. He must remain undisturbed while he carries out his work.
Adolphus looked at Charlotte. She nodded and turned back to the window. What would everyone say if she just got up and walked over to it? What would they do? Would she even be able to get it open? She'd never seen that window open. It might be sticky. A door would be better. It wouldn't be as dramatic an exit, but there was value in simplicity and ease. Would anyone stop her if she got up and walked out? If she just kept going? She nudged the uneaten fish off her fork and instead cut a small boiled potato in two. She wasn't really hungry, but she had to eat something. If for no other reason, then she'd hear about it later from Augusta. The king's mother had many opinions on the topic of how best to gestate a future monarch. So Charlotte ate the potato. And she didn't crawl out a window or walk through a door, even though she very much wanted to. Later that night, when they were listening to music in the sitting room, Augusta leaned in and said, for Charlotte's ears alone,
Dearest, the hard part is done. You have done your duty. You have conceived an heir. Now you are free.
Charlotte did not feel free. But what could be the point in saying so?
As for my son, Augusta went on, you never even have to see him again, if that is what you want. Well, at least not until we need another heir.
Charlotte gave her a tight, tiny smile. I'm going to go to bed now, she said.
Of course,
Augusta said. She patted her on the arm.
You are tired. You must have your rest.
But Charlotte was more than tired. It was something different. It was more than a need for sleep. She wanted to lie down. Not because she needed rest, but because she just couldn't bring herself to keep walking and talking and smiling and doing all the things people expected of her. She just wanted to lie down, close her eyes, disappear. Buckingham House, the gardens. 3 days later. Weather permitting, Charlotte forced herself to go outside for at least an hour each day. The crisp air felt good against her skin. Sometimes the sting of it seemed like the only reminder that she was still alive. Her brain felt mushy. She was not using her mind, and she was just so tired all the time. Still, some little piece of her backbone forced her to don her cloak and head out into the winter air. Or maybe it was a little piece of her corset. It was hard to tell the difference these days. As usual, she found herself wandering near the king's gardens. There was nothing left of note, just some dried-up vines and decaying leaves.
"Shall we replant for next year?"
Brimsley asked. "No," she said. "Let it die." It was not right to offer hope, even to plants.
"Your Majesty," Brimsley said.
She looked at him. His eyes were filled with concern and sorrow. She tried to smile. He really did care for her, and she did not thank him for it nearly enough.
"You cannot leave," he said.
"I know that." She shouldn't have written to Adolphus. Deep down, she'd known it could go nowhere.
"England,"
he said. He straightened his cravat, tugging on it as if it had suddenly grown a half inch too tight.
"You cannot leave England."
Her eyes held his. Did she understand him correctly? Was he advising her to leave the palace? "You cannot come with me," she said.
"I must remain by your..."
"No," she said, cutting him off. "You will be blamed if you accompany me. You must stay here."
"But..."
"I will not allow you to take my punishment. You have done..." She swallowed. Brimsley had been her one constant in England, the only person who had always been on her side. "You must remain blameless."
"You know where to go?"
he asked. But it was really a statement. They both knew where she would go. Danbury House, the sitting room. 1 hour later.
"Your Majesty, to what do I owe the pleasure?"
Charlotte crossed the room and sat in the chair Lady Danbury had motioned to. "I am here to offer my official condolences, of course. Sorrows, prayers." Agatha was far too polite to point out that it had been several months since her husband had died. Charlotte had been counting on that.
"How very kind," Agatha said. "But Your Majesty should be lying in, resting at home. This is a most critical time."
Charlotte's lips began to quiver. No tears. There could not be tears. She was the queen. She did not cry.
"Your Majesty?"
Agatha reached out and took her hand.
"Charlotte?"
"Home," Charlotte repeated. "That place is no home. I have left that place, and I am never, never going back." Agatha looked plainly aghast.
"But where will Your Majesty go?"
Charlotte let out a loud sniffle. "Why, I have come here." Agatha blinked several times.
"Here, Your Majesty?"
"Surely you have an extra room?"
"Yes, of course, but..."
"I shall not be a bother."
"It would, of course, be an honour to host you, but..."
"Thank you," Charlotte said, with great emotion. Agatha stood.
"If you will excuse me for a moment."
She hurried to the door.
"You will be all right in my absence?"
"Of course," Charlotte said.
"I will send in biscuits."
"That would be lovely."
Tea?"
"Yes, thank you." Agatha nodded again. She looked a bit frenzied, to be honest. Then she shut the door. Charlotte sighed and allowed herself to slump into the chair. She was so glad she'd done this. She would be comfortable here. So much better than Buckingham House.